Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Hello and welcome to episode 179 of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guests this week are Tim Owen, Mike Palmer and Andy Airy, who are collectively known as the Three Dads Walking. And Tim, Mike and Andy are three dads bereaved by suicide who have been walking in memory of their daughters, Emily, Beth and Sophie. And in 2021, they walked 300 miles between their three homes to highlight the fact that suicide is the biggest killer of young people across the entire UK. In 2022, they set off again, this time walking 600 miles between the parliaments of the four nations, petitioning the government to make suicide prevention a compulsory part of the school curriculum. They collected over 100,000 signatures for this petition, which prompted a debate in the House of Commons and led to them sitting down with the Prime Minister. And along the way, they've raised more than £1 million for Papyrus, which is a UK charity dedicated to the prevention of suicide and the promotion of positive mental health and emotional well-being in young people. And this year, they'll be undertaking the Walk of Hope, covering 500 miles and visiting newly opened offices of Papyrus all over the UK, many of which have been set up thanks to the dads' fundraising efforts. Any minute now, they also have a book out. It's called Three Dads Walking, 300 Miles of Hope, and it's been written up from the diary entries that the dads have been writing throughout their adventures. And this episode, it feels like a really special episode. It certainly felt like that during the recording of it. I spent a long time with the dad's story in the build-up to the recording, and while I always pride myself on the amount of prep that I do, because it was a four-way conversation, I really wanted to make sure that I knew the story and that I was on point with all of it. So I spent a lot of time reading up on the dads before the recording, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about them since the recording. The episodes that I do around suicide, they always sit with me a little bit. Depending on how much you know about my story and the story behind this podcast, you may or may not know that I've had my own brushes with suicide as part of my own mental health story. And that can sometimes be a lot to sit with. And of course, now I'm a lot better. I look at that through the lens of being a dad, like Tim, Mike and Andy are dads. And I'm also a son, and I look at it through that lens too. So there was a lot for me to think about in this episode. And chatting to the dads, you can really feel the weight of the grief and the sadness and the anger and the everything that comes with what they've been through. But you can also feel the hope and the driving passion that they have to use that to make big changes in the world, which is exactly what they've been doing. I don't think I've ever had an episode that both warmed my heart and broke my heart in equal measure. And I just think what the dads have been doing and what they continue to do is wonderful. And it was a privilege to get to chat to them. It was a privilege that I didn't take lightly for a single second. When I got in touch with them, actually, it was just coincidence about the book and the walk and everything. I didn't know they had a book out when I emailed them. I knew they were walking again. I didn't know when they were starting. And they've just been on this big press tour because these guys are really well known now. They've been on the telly. They've done all these big podcasts, these interviews backed by big media outlets. But I wasn't on the presser for any of that. I just happened to email them at the right time. And it just goes to show how lovely they are, because they didn't have to come and do my podcast. They're doing plenty. They've got a lot going on. So I was really touched by that, particularly when I found out how busy they are at the moment. And yeah, it was a beautiful thing. And like I say, I'm very, very proud of this episode. And they're just the loveliest men. They're so much fun. And yeah, I've thought about them a lot since talking to them. Their socials, their website, all of that is in the episode notes. I've put the link to the Papyrus website as well. Go and see what they're up to. While I've got you, I'd like to recommend another episode. Probably about this time last year, I spoke to a guy called Zanny Byrne, who's behind a project called Tandem Against Suicide. And Zanny was riding a tandem around the edge of the UK also raising money for Papyrus and raising awareness around suicide prevention. And when I spoke to Zanny, he was about halfway through his journey, but he was riding around the edge of the UK on a tandem and he was picking up people for each leg of the journey on the spare seat. And all the people he was picking up have been bereaved by suicide or affected by suicide in some way. And he was chatting to them about it and learning from them all the way round. And that was an incredible episode. Another one that was a real privilege to be a part of. So if you like this, if you like what the dads are up to, you'd probably like that one as well. So go back and have a listen. So yeah, there you go. I feel like this intro has gone on for a long time. So I'll do the salesy bit nice and quick and let's just crack on with the conversation. If you want to watch this, it's up on Patreon. The link's in the episode notes. It's a great way to support the show. Another great way to support the show is to leave a review wherever you're listening to this episode. So here we are. This is episode 179 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Tim, Mike and Andy, the three dads walking. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guests this week are Andy, Mike, and Tim, otherwise known as the Three Dads Walking. Good evening, fellas. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Tom,
good. Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining me. I'm amazed. I can tell that you guys are sort of veterans at this now, at this media stuff, because the idea that you can get three diaries all synced at first time of asking is quite impressive, to be honest with you. So you're getting good at this now, guys, is it?
Yeah. You just were lucky one.
Yeah, I only just made it back. I've just walked in now. So yeah.
Cutting it fine. Oh mate. Well, I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. We've got a lot of ground to cover, guys. You know, we've got a lot of things to talk about today. And, you know, some of those are really, really lovely things and some of those are really challenging things. And, you know, it's important to talk about both of those. And I wanted to start today. I was wondering if we could have a chat about your girls, you know, because that's the underlying foundation, the reason behind that's going to inform everything that we talk about today. Andy, would you mind going first, mate? Would you like to tell us a little bit about Sophie?
Yeah, Sophie was fantastic. Great fun. She was 29 when she died, so a bit older than Beth and Emily, and we had pleasure of doing all kinds of things. You know, as she was growing up, spent a lot of time in the outdoors because my background is in the outdoor trade, so we did a lot of walking, and as she got older, some running and skiing. In fact, the place we're going to go skiing tomorrow is where the last time I skied with Scope, so I'll have some poignant memories. But she was just a great lass to be with, very sociable, very outgoing, very loud and funny. Really enjoyed her company. You know, you kind of thought that she was going to have a good life, really. She was going through, in 2018, the autumn of 2018, she started going through a bit of a crappy patch because she'd split up with her husband. She'd chosen to leave him. It was her choice, and we were worried about her, but we weren't, you know, worried that she was going to be happy, but we weren't worried about her feeling suicidal. It just didn't cross our minds. So when she took her own life in December 2018, it just shattered us, and miss her every day.
Oh, mate. Yeah, thank you for sharing that, mate. I really, really appreciate it. Tim, could you tell us a little bit about Emily, please?
So Em was 19 when she died, and that was in March 2020. Em was life and soul of the party, big bubbly, you know, big bubbly personality. But there was another side of Em that a lot of people didn't see, and that was a side that sometimes struggled with life. She'd always been a bit different to our other children. Emotional kind of regulation was all over the place. And she went through a really dark period when she was kind of 13 to 15. And we were getting support from a load of services, but we were struggling in that time. She was definitely struggling. She did have some suicide attempts that saw her put into hospital. But she was diagnosed in 2015 with high-functioning autism. And that changed everything. It changed the way we dealt with Emily. It changed the way she dealt with herself. It was devastation for a 15-year-old young lady to be told that. We've been asking for years for support and saying, you know, is something wrong? She's just different. We didn't know what it was. We couldn't put our finger on it. And that diagnosis changed everything. She got so much support then going to school. She got some qualifications. She worked in our local pub part-time initially, then kind of full-time. It's a community pub. And I used to go in there and drink with my local friends on a Thursday night and see her hold court in there. It, you know, really the life and soul. Talk to anyone. Incredibly caring. Couldn't hated injustice in the world. And that was probably her kind of high-functioning autism. It was black or white. And she, to help with her autism and just emotionally regulate, she loved going to the gym. She was an absolute gym bunny. So she, after finishing school, she went to art college, incredible artist. Did that for a bit, got a kind of a BTEC there. Then she did a fitness training apprenticeship, just a level two for about 8 months or something. And then she was working in the pub. But gym was a massive part of what she wanted to do. Working in the pub was brilliant. It gave her some kind of a focus. It gave her money. And that allowed her to run a bright red Mini that she drove around the lanes in Norfolk. And the Mini, her driving was her freedom. We live rurally, so it gave her freedom and she loved it. And unfortunately, when it was just before the week, well, just before lockdown, the week before lockdown, we'd started coughing in the house. And the rules at the time were if anyone's coughing, you have to stay in. And the pub was closing. She wasn't allowed to go to the gym. And she asked, she was coughing on the Tuesday and she asked to go out, woke up in the morning. She was quite agitated. She asked us if she could go out to take the dog up to the beach. We said, no, you can't. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Basically, she couldn't cope with that, her parents or their restrictions. And she went out and tried to take her life. And we kind of found her about 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later. I don't know. It's all a blur. It's just devastation. Mm. And she ended up in hospital on life support. And 5 days later, she died. And it just blew us apart. It absolutely, just like Andy said, there are no words. It's just your life. You have all these plans in life that, you know, you're going to do this, that, and the other. Your kids are going to do this, that, and the other. And this just absolutely blows you apart. And just devastation. But she was lovely. Bless her.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you, mate. And Mike, would you like to tell us a bit about Beth, please?
Yes. Beth died 5-6 days after Tim lost Emily. Beth was just 17 years old. She was training to be a vocal artist. She was at college in Manchester. She was exceptionally talented. I don't know where she got her voice from, but she was starting to gig. She was very much life and soul. She was immensely talented at college, and I could never understand that she could pick up a guitar and just play it. You know, she was very, very witty, very quick. Like Sophie and Emily, she was life and soul of the party. You know, she could dance as well. But the thing is, she was such a loving daughter. You know, she was the happiest little kid you could ever meet. She was, you know, she was the kid that used to sit on my shoulders, hold my hand, you know, loved Harry Potter, loved Pirates of the Caribbean, Johnny Depp. You know, she was into everything you possibly could. Her life was basically full of hope, you know, and she wanted to do things, wanted to achieve things. But the last person in the world you would have thought would take her own life. But I think lockdown had a lot to do with it. She saw a lot of things being cancelled, her gigs, the festival she wanted to go to. She couldn't finish college with her friends. But I do think as well, she'd been going through a period, maybe not brilliant mental health, but, you know, when I talk about this, I talk about facts. I do think I miss things she said, maybe a behaviour had changed, but it's all mixed up in a teenage world as well. You know, but Beth was basically there 1 minute and gone the next. And, you know, the world you end up in, you know, it everything changes. All the colour goes from it. You know, they say, you know, devastation, you are devastated, but that's too small a word. You know, it certainly plunged me into a pit of absolute depression, of grief. You know, I went from a you know, a supposedly strong, stereotypical firefighter dealt with so much, and I couldn't even speak or recognize my family. But I think what you could take from this, you know, Emily, Sophie and Beth's stories are all the same. Sorry, are all different, all very different. But the same, the thing that's the similarity is they were both absolutely loved as daughters, you know, and we're now left with huge holes in our life. But that's how we've come together as well, to get some positive out of this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, thank you, Mace. And I think it's so important to talk about. You know, I've had the privilege of being able to interview a lot of people who have been bereaved by suicide because of the nature of this podcast. And a lot of people have said to me that because of the stigma around suicide and because of the myths around suicide, that people are almost like reluctant to ask because they're scared to even say the word suicide. But the way someone dies is often the least interesting thing about them, right? And there's all this life, there's all this, all these wonderful things to celebrate. And I think people want to, as part of the grieving process, as part of the bereavement process, you guys want to talk and celebrate all the good and lovely things as well. But it's they find it difficult to ask about suicide. It's a complicated space, isn't it?
And one of the things along the way, we've met so many people, so many suicide bereaved people. And one of the most important things that we've learned is the need to talk. You've got to be able to share more information and stories about the person that's missing, because talking about them keeps them very close to you. I think because of what we've been doing, we've talked about our girls, well, every day, one way or another, I suppose. And it does feel as though, certainly for me, it feels those so very close. But yeah, that stigma and the taboo that surrounds suicide is there. And it's so important that we do talk about it, because we've got to smash it, because the only way we can save lives going forward is by talking about suicide. You know, actually not talking about it doesn't help anybody. And so one of the most important things that we've done is created a bit of a safe space where people are almost allowed to talk about suicide if they're interacting with us, or walking with us or meeting us or whatever. And we know that helps save lives.
Yeah, very much so.
It shocked us on the first walk. We obviously went on BBC Breakfast Live at the start, and we were getting loads of money, and it was incredible, the support that we had. But as we left Moreland, which is Andy's Village Hall, and literally we were walking out of the gates at the hall, the first suicide bereaved mom joined us. And then we had another, half a mile, less than that, quarter of a mile later, who came, and very different stories. But I don't think any of us appreciated how we would attract so many suicide bereaved parents and just wider families. And when you lose a loved one to suicide, you feel so totally isolated. You know, and the three of us joining up, me and Mike to start with, through a total fluke, through our surviving children, suddenly you've got somebody. Peer support is so, so, so important in this space. Because suddenly you're with somebody that gets it, that totally understands. Both Mike and Andy spoke about there's no word for what you're feeling afterwards. And it's so complex, that bit afterwards. And to have other people that understand you and don't have to, you don't have to explain it to them. It is so kind of liberating for you as a suicide bereaved dad. And as Andy said, talking about it is just so, so, so important.
Mike, go for it, mate. I think there's probably
stereotypically, again, that word again, you know, sort of men don't talk, you know, we're a bit unusual, us three, because you can't shut us up, and you'll learn this as this podcast goes on. But it is, as Andy said, it's so important to talk, and we learnt, especially, you know, the first walk, what we learnt, talking about suicide and everything is part of postvention side. It's part of moving on with life as well. We met people who've been bereaved by decades, and had not really spoken about their loss because of the stigma and taboo. And just having the conversation with someone who understands as well, it's so important. With the stories we heard, and we're honoured to listen to all of these stories, we're not experts. You know, we are three ordinary dads, heartbroken dads. But to be able to talk to someone who is actually feeling the same as you, you know, it's important. It's important stuff.
Yeah, it's a really important thing, yeah.
The thing with us, obviously we lost Soph. I'm about 14 months ahead of Mike and Tim. And when we lost Soph at that Christmas 2018, over that Christmas period, we were scratching around looking, organising a funeral. But we were looking for a suicide prevention charity to support. And it was fascinating when you looked around, because when you Google suicide prevention charities, you get Samaritans and Mind come up, which we obviously recognised, but then loads of others. And I'm actually a trustee of a small environmental charity in the Lake District. And so when you look at charities, you kind of think big charities can look after themselves. So who out of all these smaller ones should I support? And so I contacted a friend of ours whose background was in mental health charities. And Sarah pointed us immediately at Papyrus, Prevention of Young Suicide. And of course, we'd never heard of them. It was, why would we? You know, it's not, you know, suicide wasn't something that ever happened to us until it did. And so we looked at Papyrus, and it turns out they were blooming brilliant, the work that they were doing then and continue to do now. But then we ended up raising quite a lot of money at Soph's funeral, but then I ended up doing a lot of other things under the hashtag Run for Sophie. I actually ran a half marathon using Sophie's entry and subsequently ran other half marathons and did hula hooping and skipping and all kinds of weird, wonderful things. But I realised along the way that the money was actually the byproduct. The thing that the real output was actually getting people to talk about suicide prevention and introducing them to Papyrus and other suicide prevention charities. But it was that the step was opening people's eyes to, you know, if you look at the Papyrus website, it says right on the front that for under 35s, suicide's the biggest killer in the UK, which is a crazy thought. So it was that idea of getting people talking and raising awareness was the key output. And the money helped. Money was great as well, but the real thing was actually getting people talking about suicide prevention.
Yeah, it's kind of like humanizing those statistics, right? Because we see the numbers all the time. You see the numbers to the point where you almost kind of like, you just know them, and it's not even shocking anymore because you get used to seeing them, and you forget behind every percentage, behind every number, behind every statistic is a person and a family and you know, actual people that are dealing with this stuff. And to put faces to it, to put voices to it, it really makes such a big difference. Yeah. Tim, did you mention before that it was you and Mike that connected first? Is that how
how we kind of got together? It was 4 weeks after Emma died, and you've got to kind of go back to 2020 when you weren't talking to anyone. We just had Em's funeral with six people at it, you know, this bright 19-year-old girl, six people at a funeral. We're just in crisis, just functioning. And it was my eldest daughter who came to me one day and just said, "Dad, I'm talking to this man in Manchester." Now, my eldest daughter is Miss Sensible. She's a teacher now, so she is absolute Miss Sensible. And I'm going, "Addie, what are you doing? We don't need this in our lives. Who are you talking to?" No. It's a man like us. You know, it's a dad. He's in the same situation. And she'd reached out through social media. She'd seen the story of Beth on social media. She'd reached out to Beth's sister, Emily, so Mike's other daughter, Mike's other daughters, and somehow they'd got kind of exchanging messages. And then Emily had obviously gone to her dad, Mike, and said, "There's a strange girl from Norfolk talking to me." Mike had ended up talking to Annabelle, my eldest. And so it was a month after Emily died, and kind of about 3 weeks after Beth, that Mike and I texted each other, and then we spoke the following day. And that was an incredibly powerful conversation because we were so, our grief was so raw, and we're both, nothing's exactly the same, but we were on similar paths. We were, and we just kind of made this pact there and then to whatever happens, if you're feeling like, you know, not in a good place, whatever time of day or night it was, we'd give each other a call. And we spoke so regularly after that, for several months after that, both of us knowing that we needed help because this was too big for us each to handle. And we were very inquisitive. So Mike, we'll talk in a minute about how he found Papyrus. I've never heard of this charity, Papyrus. The mental health professionals that Emma had been under 5 years earlier had never told us anything about. I didn't even know there was a suicide prevention charity. Who knew? And that's the whole point. So the statistics that you're talking about, because I was so curious, I know I needed help. I went to Mind and asked her for help from Mind. And there was a suicide bereavement worker that came around, and I then went on a course with them, and some of the statistics that were being thrown around from the Office of National Statistics, and Mike and I would talk about it, you know, 6,000 suicides a year in the UK. What? How can there be so many? And then we started to scratch the surface on that and work out that not everyone that dies by suicide is given or takes their own life is given a suicide verdict. They're given an open verdict or a death by misadventure or a narrative verdict, as Beth had. And then you realize that 6,000 is way more than that. It's way, way more than that. And if we put all this effort into other forms of safety risk, so road safety is the one, we put so much effort into road safety, quite rightly, because every death on the roads is tragic. There's about 2021, I think there's 1,522 people died on the roads. So 1,500 people died on the roads. The same year, 6,000 people died by suicide. And that's not including the ones that death by misadventure or open verdict. So as a society, we're doing everything we can to reduce road deaths, but we're not doing much to do about suicide. It doesn't seem as if we're taking the same level of risk. So Mike and I were quite challenged about this. There was also another thing that set us off. About 3 weeks after Mike and I started talking, I found a note from Emily, which the police had overlooked, and a beautifully written note just saying kind of why she couldn't cope anymore. And I just ripped us apart. But the two things in there was, one, don't be ashamed. And the second one, if other people can learn. And I can remember, you know, phoning Mike up in absolute, it was as though she'd just died again, honestly, the devastation. But that was almost like a green light from Em to go ahead and do something. We didn't know what. I told Mike, and we were just like, what do we do? We didn't know what. But massively, massively important that note was to kick me and Mike. And Mike and I were already inquisitive doing stuff. But that's how Mike and I kind of got together. I don't know if Mike wants to take the next bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you'd want to, Mike, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know what Tim's talking about there, you know, being a father, you think you've done everything to arm your daughter to protect herself, to keep herself safe for the, you know, for her life, you know, and it is such a devastating loss. I say that's just not a big enough word, is it? Yeah, so where are we going? I've lost my track a bit here.
How you met Andy, mate? How you met Andy?
Oh, yeah, I've just
you've forgotten about Andy. Me, mate.
I've just overlooked Andy. Yes, yeah.
Can never
just
do that.
But
basically, yeah, I started talking to Tim. You know, we're very much on the same page. And, you know, it was that thing that kept coming back, wasn't it? Suicide's the biggest killer of under 35s in the UK. We didn't know that. We didn't have to know that, because it'll never, ever affect us. You know, another figure, nearly 200 school children every year, or around about that figure, take their own lives. It's just absolutely shocking. But we never knew. But basically, as time went on, I was introduced to Papyrus by a friend of ours called Claire Benson. And I started looking at the website, and basically they were doing something called a fundraiser by something called Run the Ring. It's around the M25 in London. And this year it's a VW thing. And I had a VW camper and I saw this. And they were doing it for Papyrus. You're raising money. So myself and my wife decided we'd go. And we ended up on the radio, and they raised lots of money, around 40,000. We were introduced to Papyrus then. We started talking to them. And I had heard of this guy called Andy Airy, who'd lost his daughter about 14 months before, Sophie, and what he was doing. And he kept telling me, you must talk to Andy. You know, you'll get on really well with him. Is that true, Andy? Yeah, no. Well, Andy's a City supporter. I'm a United supporter. There's a bit of that already. No, but basically, I started doing courses with Papyrus in suicide prevention, suicide awareness. I needed to know why we'd lost Bethy. I needed to know more. Already, myself and Tim had started to just loosely start discussing about maybe walking between our homes, you know, 150 miles between Manchester and Norfolk, to illustrate the fact this is a UK-wide problem. But I bumped into Andy's son on a champions course at Papyrus. And, you know, I'd sort of started thinking about this. And I mentioned, you know, would your dad be interested in maybe something? And Gregor said, don't know, ask him. So I ended up basically getting hold of Andy. And do you want to take it from there, Andy?
Well, Gregor could have done it, actually, because he's, I don't know if you heard all the banging, he's just slammed every door in the house. As he's come in, I've been messaging him, don't slam another door. That's him arriving back from Liverpool for this ski trip. Yeah, he's gone out actually, so we're fine now. He's gone straight to the
pub for a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Gregor told me that he'd spoken to this Mang, who said
it's what I'm known as, isn't it?
Yeah, the Mang. You're not from Manchester though, Mike, are you?
Not originally.
No. So it was interesting that this person had known of me to start off with and was interested in talking to me about it. But in all honesty, I didn't really think about it, because the day that Mike and Gregor met was the day before what would have been Sophie's 31st birthday. An anniversary is a challenging. Also, it was a week before the second anniversary of Soph's death, and Christmas was coming up. So this conversation that Mike and Gregor had, that Gregor had told me about, just kind of got filed somewhere. And so I didn't think about it until sometime into the new year. My phone went, and it was Mike. And we had a conversation about what we'd gone through, and that, you know, the thing that we've touched on already, that idea of talking to other suicide bereaved parents is an incredibly powerful thing. And very, very positive, that feeling of not being alone, because suicide, it does isolate you and your family, or it can do. And we have met other suicide bereaved families who were isolated when they lost their loved ones and have remained isolated for years, decades, in fact. Anyway, so in that conversation with Mike, he told me about Tim and how Tim had really supported him and really saved his life from when Mike was in the darkest depths and feeling suicidal himself. And how that conversation had helped him. And we arranged to meet up and go for a walk, which is what we did in the spring of 2021, very early spring 2021, and had a walk quite close to us down on the bit of limestone country in what is now the Westmorland Dales, actually, which seems a bit weird for a part of Cumbria, but that's where we went. And
little did you know, a few months later, you'd be walking a bit further.
yeah. If only I'd known, Mike. If only I'd known.
I know.
But we talked a lot about our girls and the effect that their loss had had on our families and friends, and how actually talking to other people had helped us. And then Mike said, "You know, I've got an idea." Just like that, Mike, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
And he said about, I thought about walking between our houses, and he'd explained about Tim. And Mike's idea was to show that suicide doesn't discriminate and could happen to any family anywhere. We could walk between our homes. And that's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. A really simple idea. And he said, so you think you're up for that? Yeah, remind me where Tim lives, Norfolk. All right, yeah, okay. And yeah, we did it. We thought, yeah, we're going to do this. It's a really nice idea. We went back to Mike's van and he got out his 2010 road atlas, and he'd put a dot on Penrith and a dot on Manchester and a dot on Derby and a dot on Kingsley, and drawn these lines and marked them off in 20-mile intervals. You know, how far is it? 280 miles. Oh, go on then, yeah, let's do it. And then that was it. We went. We all got together on a Zoom call, I don't know, shortly thereafter. Obviously, the first time I'd then spoken to Tim, and we talked about our goals and got the feel for our families. And then before we knew it, we were in the planning stage, weren't we?
Yeah, very quickly. Very quickly, about 18 OS maps came through the door each. Yeah, and we were off marking it with like highlighters and like lipstick colours and whatever. Yeah, planning the route, and it was happening. It just evolved.
Yeah,
we kind of met up in Manchester, your house, didn't we, Mike, for the first time a couple of months later. On first night, we had quite a few beers, and then had some nice food from Helen, and then we spent the second day kind of planning. And then the next time we met was in a tap room in Manchester, the Seven Brothers, and that was the official launch. So there's a bit of a beer theme here. Yeah. And we kind of launched it. We didn't realise quite how big it was going to get. And we were just, Andy, you'd got a friend, hadn't you, Alison Friedman, who was the real key person in this. And Andy thought there'd be a bit of a human interest story. So approached Alison. And Alison was like, yeah, BBC. She's BBC Northeast, but she approached BBC Breakfast with our story, and they were suddenly well up for it. And Alison ended up coming around to all our homes and recording us. And we knew at this stage, oh, this could get big if BBC Breakfast. But at the time, our target was to raise £3,000 each. Simple as that, £9,000. And we'd have been happy with that, quite frankly. That was it, but it was a suicide prevention awareness. And all of a sudden, it was a Sunday, Mike suddenly got invited onto the BBC Breakfast Red Sofa the following morning. And it was like, oh, my word, because he lives quite close to the Media City. And I think at the end of that day, after Mike being on the Red Sofa, our total was up at 48,000. It had jumped massively in any case, from the 9,000 up to nearly 50,000. And it's like, blimey, this is going to get quite big. And then we were on our way up to Andy's to meet for the third time, weren't we? Which was the night before, the day before we were going to start walking that October. And the Papyrus, we were on a WhatsApp group with them, and they just sent us a text. Daniel Craig, as in the Daniel Craig, has just donated £10,000 and is happy to be associated. And oh my word, it just went kind of crazy. And it did, it just kind of rolled up. So the third time we met was the night before we started walking and spending the next 15 days together.
What for?
Cheek by jowl.
You know, it's one of those, we're three bereaved fathers, you know, we, what we look like, I don't know, our walking kit with our flags and things like that, it's almost ridiculous, but that's what we are. We're not three awesome athletes, we're three dads, you know, and we're prepared to talk. And what a powerful journey it was. You know, we were joined from the office, as Tim said, you know, by bereaved parents, people touched by suicide, mental health issues, you know, and just, I think, we were honoured to hear all the stories. But I think because we were very open with our feelings, we'd taken the decision to talk about our girls, to keep them almost, their memories alive, that people got it and they wanted to, you know, talk with us. And I think also the appeal of the three of us in our shorts, man spreading on the red sofa several times as well. It must have had its own appeal. Yes.
It's a limited audience, I think you're talking to there, Mike. Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint. But it was that feeling of, again, the unintended consequences or the byproduct. The money thing just turned into something ridiculous. It really did take on a life of its own. But because we were being so open and because the BBC had got hold of it and other media, Mel Barham at Granada was a great supporter, Mike, and Jane continues to be.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
And loads of radio channels. So many people were helping us spread the word. And it was that feeling of, this is a message that's going out there, that you do need to talk. You know, we've got to equip our young people with the knowledge and understanding that suicide or having suicidal thoughts isn't an unusual thing. You know, one in five of us will have a suicidal thought in our lives. So it's stupid not to talk about it. We need to tell people that this is actually quite a normal thing, and here's what you can do. Here are some techniques or understanding that you can or signposting to people who can help. But the other thing that had happened, so that was like when I was doing the Run for Sophie stuff, it was like the same thing but multiplied thousands of times. But then the other thing that was amazing was this accidental creation of a really safe space around us, and that people coming out to share their stories with us, either where they lost loved ones or there were suicide survivors. A lot of suicide survivors came out and talked to us. And we'd talked about this before we'd set off walking, because we were carrying a tracker. And so people could follow us in real time. So we deliberately opened ourselves up to be approached. We knew that was going to happen, but we didn't really appreciate how many people would actually come out and find us.
Scale of it, no.
Yeah, there was a few, wasn't there? But that, and so we were kind of a little concerned, because we didn't know how we would react to what we would be told. But as we said earlier on, within half a mile, we'd met two suicide bereaved families. And they talked very openly about what they were feeling and what had happened. And it was quite clear that the conversation that they were having with us was helping them. It was absolutely obvious in their faces that sharing their stories was helping. And so as that walk went on, it became, it did both, like Mike said, it was an honor. It was a real privilege to listen to these stories and do it in the knowledge that you could see it was helping people. It's not unburdening, but it definitely was lightening the load somehow. And the weird thing was, from our perspective, it wasn't landing on us. It wasn't like we were taking on other people's grief. Just in that process of the conversation, the sharing of emotions and expressions of love and care, it was helping. And it helped them. And it was helping us as well. It was really quite a weird thing to have...
Yeah,
we'd not done it by design. It just
not at all.
I think it almost empowered us. But the thing was, people often asked, "How did you, Andy and Tim, get on?" Well, we hardly talked to each other when we're walking. we didn't sort of walk in a group and talk. Usually, these people who joined us went from each one of us in turn, and had conversations there. So, but it was some powerful story. But we learnt a lot when we were walking as well. And basically, it came down to, we're not equipping our young people to deal with these pressures, suicidal thoughts. There's a lot of things that need doing, but we had to draw a line in the sand somewhere. And we came to the decision, really, when we were walking, we learnt that basically we need to do more in schools. We need to teach our young people about their greatest danger that is themselves. And basically, we need to teach suicide prevention in schools age appropriately and sensitively. So when we actually got over the line in Sheldon, we knew that basically we'd finished that walk, but we'd not finished our journey, if you like.
Yeah.
Was there any, when you guys finished, was there much of a come down in between walk one and week two? Because I'd imagine like you've just had this really just emotional, cathartic, incredible experience that you really didn't see coming at all. And then, once all the sort of the noises died down and you're sort of back at home and, it must be such a strange thing to go from one world to that world and then back to the first one.
I certainly had a real come down. Yeah, it sort of things. I was trying to go back to work at the time, and basically I couldn't cope. We'd stayed at a level where we're walking, but when it comes down to it, the grief and everything is still there, And yes, it took me a little while to come back up, but never lost focus of what we needed to do. And when it comes down to it, what we're doing as three dads walking, it very much gives me a focus. I know it does with Andy, Tim as well. Every day we get up and that's what we're doing. But it in our world where we are of grief, it is good things. You meet wonderful people. It's a positive thing. And we do, 100% know that we can make a change.
Yeah. I think when we crossed the line Alison asked her, didn't she, about what's it feel like to have finished? It's like, well, we've finished the walk, but there's more to do. There's more to do. And that was the engagement with government that went on and is still going on now, as well, you know, that led us into the second walk, to walk between all four parliaments, the petition on the second walk, you know, there was a whole snowball effect that started. And the walk and that first step from the village hall was the kind of starting point. And we're still on that journey. So although that physical journey was done at the end of the first walk, we knew there was stuff. We, you know, Andy's great for writing letters. He's brilliant. So we just set Andy and pull it back and, you know, writing into the government, et cetera. And just getting support from all sorts of people. And the people that we've engaged with have been absolutely incredible, from politicians from all backgrounds, just society, I should say, the different people that we've spoken to. And that, as Mike says, has kind of kept us going, but definitely drove us from the first walk into the second walk to walk between the four parliaments of the UK.
We went from 300 miles to 600 miles. We thought we'd double it for the second walk.
We're getting good at it. Yeah. it was fascinating, that finishing, because I was very mindful of that potential crash that we would have. But I got completely wound up on the walk because of all these suicide brief parents who said that they'd only found suicide prevention charities like Papyrus after they'd lost their loved ones. And it was only then that they found out that suicide's the biggest killer of under 35s. And they all said, well, why didn't anybody tell us? Or, you know, why didn't anybody tell them? If this, and it was that. I'd kind of really got myself, well, we'd all got worked up on it.
It
was that feeling of, yeah, what if this is the biggest killer? Why aren't we doing something? And as Tim said, I can be quite a prolific letter writer if I put my mind to it. and so, in fact, my wife tells me quite often to stop writing letters. Stop doing that. Who are you writing to now? Not Neil Hudson. Neil Hudson's our MP. You're not writing to Neil again.
Poor Neil.
What
a huge support he's been to us.
He's been a star. But so I'd kind of, it was weird the end, because we all ended up back on the red sofa on the Monday morning, didn't we? And it was, so we got you, it was fine for me and Mike, because obviously Mike was going back to Manchester and we were coming back to Cumbria, but somehow we had to get Tim up the road and back down
to Norfolk.
So that was weird. But once I'd got home and got everything kind of back in its place here, it just felt like there was that feeling of, no, we've got to keep going, just keep doing stuff. And that led to the letters to the government, which, as Tim said, that conversation is still ongoing 2 years later. But then the other thing that we did, which I really enjoyed it, was we decided we would try and capture what had happened. Because on the walk, about second day in, we were talking away, and there's, in the conversation, it was like, there's a book here. and it really was, yeah. We need to, and we had been writing down, we'd got journals, so we captured stuff. And we'd had all these videos that we'd taken, obviously the BBC and others had shot loads. And we'd sent out loads of social media stuff. So we had this kind of great resource of a record of what had happened. And so I wrote my take on, this was it, how we got together, the planning, and then the 15 days of the walk. And so I did that over a few weeks and sent it to Mike and Tim, and then they added their bits in. And it, before we knew it, we'd got effectively a book. We had 70,000 words, wasn't it?
We'd all kept the journals separate. Every night, when we were kind of absolutely wiped out, we kind of scrawled notes, each of us. And so, yeah, Andy put everything down, then Mike and I put our takes on it, and that's how it kind of then developed into some sort of book. But that was...
It was incredible,
the process.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I kept a journal as well in the days after I lost Beth. I've no idea. Yeah. I'd no idea why I actually did that. But it was a diary of what I felt, the grief and all the thoughts as well. And some of that's gone into the book too.
Yeah,
but amazing. That's important because it yeah, it's pretty raw, but
It's like you say, it's important. Yeah. I always say on this podcast, you know, some of the things that we talk about are hard to listen to, and they should be, because they were hard to live and they were hard for people to go through, right? So there's no point, you know, pulling punches on it. You know, that's life.
But we do hope the book shows there is hope for those who are struggling and in crisis, but also those bereaved by suicide as well, because the ripple effect afterwards, you know, you're 80 to 300%. Well, more likely to take your own life if you've been bereaved. I get that. But we are, as you can see, we are laughing. You know, we still have our times where we are down, but we do laugh and life goes on. And Andy often says this about feeling, gives you, as time goes on, you become a little more insulated to some of the feelings and you know how to maybe process them a bit more, you know, and having a point and everything and doing what we're doing is, you know, hugely important. But we met so many people, we walked as well, who also started their own charities and things and doing different things to support people and prevent, you know, more suicides and support people with their mental health. And it's absolutely inspirational.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? When you start to, I always think with the whole conversation around, you know, mental health in general, it seems to me like there's a very definitive line of people who know about it and people who don't. And it's that simple. And then something awful happens. And then suddenly you start finding out about this stuff. And there's amazing things out there. There's people in local communities that are doing all this incredible stuff. And the hardest thing is getting people to know about them and to have the conversations about them. And that is the tricky thing. There's kind of a, you know, with mental health awareness, which is obviously such a big catchphrase in recent years, but it's almost an echo chamber, right? So I know that I can go on my social media and say mental health awareness, and everyone who follows me will go, yeah, mental health awareness, but we're all aware. Like, there's no, like, I'm speaking to the converted, right? It's so, but stuff like, you know, like what you guys have done with these walks and like with the book coming out, that's the beauty of it, is because it's falling into the laps. It's getting onto that red sofa. It's getting into the eyes of the people that might need to know this stuff, you know, and they don't, you know, and that's kind of where the conversation needs to shift now a bit, I think.
Well, I think I was going to say about feedback, because we've been so open, we get loads of feedback. A lot comes back through the Three Dads Walking website or on the social media stuff that we put on. And once, when we've been high profile during the walks, the sheer volume of that comes back to us is so positive, where people are thanking us in terms of introducing people to Papyrus and the Hopeline 24/7, the crisis line, or just by being open and talking about our experiences. The number of parents that have come back to us and have said thank you because they've used us as a like an opening gambit in a conversation that they could do safely about suicide prevention, because they could point at us lot and go, look what these people are doing, and you know why they're doing it.
Yeah. Well, look at these three funny old men with flags.
And what about that grumpy one in the middle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the constant feedback that we've had, and through the charities as well, through Papyrus especially, you know, they've, when we walked that first time, that the first week, they said that their calls had gone up by 20% to Hopeline 24/7. But interestingly, the one thing they reported then was that they'd seen for the first time dads actually phoning up asking for help. Because prior to us, it had always been mums that had phoned up to say they're worried. And because of us lot chuntering away as three dads, it had encouraged dads to pick up phones, which I thought was fantastic. Quite amazing, isn't it?
That's a beautiful thing, right? There's so much power when someone goes first, because everything's around talking, but how do you talk if you haven't got the words? How do you talk if you don't know what to say, right? And if someone goes first, and it's like gives everyone else unofficial permission to say, well, maybe I could do that, you know, and it just it gets the ball rolling, doesn't it? Gets the ball rolling.
Our third walk now, this is what we want to highlight, the new offices that are opening with Papyrus down the east side of the country. And basically, we want every corner of the UK to know about Papyrus, but also know about Hope Line 247. You know, it's too important. It's just that chance that someone might ring that number and, spreading awareness. Sorry, Tim.
No, I was about to say exactly the same. The key point in this, that the three of us and our girls didn't know that it was suicide prevention charities. And as Andy's already said, all of the parents that we met were just going, why did no one tell us? Why did no one tell us these suicide prevention charities? So the awareness is the key thing. It's making mums, dads, brothers and sisters aware, you know, school kids aware that there is a charity out there that might just save your friend's life, your daughter's life, your son's life. And, you know, even if that's 1% chance, all three of us would take that 1% chance. People play the lottery, right? A lot less chance than that. So, you know, it's so worth it. And just in passing, so many times just in doing stuff at events, you know, people have said, what are you working for? They haven't heard the story. And then they'll start to open up and, oh, my brother, yeah, he's in a really bad place. And give them your little wristband for Hope Line 247. They'll take it away. And it's just so, so, so important that people know that there's a... When Em was struggling, when she was, you know, between 13 and 15, the only out... she was being looked after by the services, CAMS, and you know, everyone was involved. Out of hours, the only emergency line we had was the police. That's it. And that is just shocking. And our friends are police officers, and they were saying, you know, 50% of the stuff that they get out of hours is, you know, people in crisis. And the only place if that person is in crisis in their own home, the police can't do anything. If they're in crisis outside of their home, they can take them in. And the only place they can put them is in a cell. Well, if someone's in a mental health crisis, locking them in a cell is probably a bad thing. And it's not the police's fault, you know. It's just the services are so, so stretched. And that goes back to our first point. Our main point is prevention, prevention, prevention. Let's not wait for people to be in crisis and relying on the police, relying on, you know, the emergency lines. If we can get people into a place when their head is in a good place about knowing about suicide prevention, putting a suicide prevention plan, which sounds really grand, it's not. A suicide prevention plan is just going, you know what, if I know there's a high 1 in 5 chance that at some point in my life I'll feel like taking my own life. So what am I going to do? Well, when I'm in a good place, I'm going to come up with a plan. So when I hit that dip, I know I've got to take the dog for a walk, listen to some music, call me mom, call me dad, speak to my brother, speak to my friend, play a game, watch my favorite movie. Whatever it is, put that plan in place so that when they hit that rock bottom, they go right. And also knowing that we'd all said if our girls had counted to 10, they probably wouldn't have made the same decision. When you're speaking to suicide prevention professionals and they say, well, on average, those dark thoughts last for about 15 minutes. So you know you've got to get through yourself through that dark period for 15 minutes. It's just articulating the risk and then being able to do something about it. And that's what it's simply about, is telling people there is hope.
Yeah. I think the most powerful stories we hear are from those who have struggled, been in crisis, some cases attempted to take their own lives, but are now living lives they want to. Not every day may be brilliant, but they know how to cope. And because of that, their family, friends, they have them as well. There's no ripple effect there as well, you know, and just knowing that and hearing those stories, it's powerful. So there's always hope and there's always a chance.
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know, right? And there's, you know, and it's that simple. There was something that was on your website that I actually scribbled down on my notes, guys. And you know, I'm very conscious of your time. So there's a couple of things I want to touch on, and then I'm going to let you go. But
getting me out of making tea.
I'll carry on for 5 minutes, just to long enough to get you out of it. But under the values and belief section on your website, there was a under the heading of learning, and you put everyone has a role to play in preventing young suicides, and that really stood out to me, right? Because if everyone does a little bit and everyone's looking out for something different, you know, a little bit at school, a little bit at home, you mentioned the situation with the police before, and that's taking a whole thing and put it on one service that's stretched to bits, right?
But
that really stood out to me, how everyone's got a role, everyone can help in some way, and all that comes together to make a bigger picture, a more powerful thing. That just made so much sense to me.
Well, it's a title change, isn't it?
Now, I'm just going to say this.
Go on, Andy.
No, I was going to say it's been really interesting with our engagement with government, because all we've done there is ask one really simple question, which is, if suicide is the biggest risk to our young people, why don't we tell them about it? And so that question has led us to speak to loads of civil servants, ministers, up to and including the Prime Minister. And it, and from our perspective, it's really a simple thing to do, because it's just one question, and there's nobody's said yet, this is the reason why we're not doing it. There is some nervousness about suicide and suicide prevention and talking to young people, but when you talk to the experts, it's quite clear that those conversations can be had in an age-appropriate and safe way. So this is the biggest risk. Why aren't we talking about it? So that's the real simple bit for us as Three Dads Walking. But you're right, what Mike said is what we're after, is a societal change. So we are trying to change society, but it's that one question that's at the heart of it. Because eventually the government, whether it's this current one or the next one that comes in, will change the curriculum. And this will come into schools, and age-appropriate lessons will be taught from junior schools, where they'll be teaching help-seeking behaviour to start off with. And that idea that if you're in any difficulty, the thing to do is ask for help, not to try and solve the problems. So that will happen. It's going to happen, which will mean in a few years' time, as these young people go through school learning that behaviour, when they become adults, we're in a completely different place. But we've got to start somewhere. And not talking about it is plain stupid.
Very much so.
In schools as well, I mean, schools are there to equip our young people with the skills they need to thrive in life. You know, and if we don't, suicide prevention needs to be a line in the sand somewhere. We also need to work a lot on many more life skills and things. There's a lot of pressures on our young people now, social media, the internet being that there. But we need a balance as well between academic qualifications and life skills. There's no point in having a ruck of academic qualifications if you haven't got the life skills to be resilient and, to say, thrive in life. So we need to get that balance there as well.
Yeah. And again, we've met so many parents of people who have been at university and taken their own lives. And I know there's a big thing going about duty of care to students at university. But just as Mike says, at the moment, we train our kids to get loads of GCSEs, loads of A-levels, bin them off to university, and then don't give them the mechanism to support themselves at university. And the parents that we've spoken to, and well, all three of us as well, we'd much rather have a daughter or a son that's alive with less qualifications than a son or a daughter that's got absolute the best qualifications in the world that just couldn't keep themselves safe, because that's just pointless.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. And, you know, the exam stress is a massive factor in young people's mental health problems as well, right? So it's kind of like, yeah, it kind of comes for full circle. We've touched on the book already. That's on its way. I saw on your social media that you've been doing the audio book. That must have been I always like asking people about audio books. It's such a wild thing, I think. But that's on its way, right? That's the release is imminent.
April 4th
of April. Yeah.
That's on the way. How was that, the audiobook experience?
It was hard.
An experience. Yes.
sitting in that little tiny cubbyhole of a studio where there's just you and a mic and an iPad to read off.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
And a very, very tolerant producer next door. So every mistake you made.
Yes.
Can you just get back? Yes. Can you just start that one again? Replay the, and it took, it was 2 days full on. I mean, I'm useless in any case, but it was, you know, it's our personal stories. It's our girls. And that was emotional. But then rereading some of the stories that are in there of other people and their stories and the stories of their children, or not just children, could be fathers and other bereaved people. You know, you're just reading it off the text, just black and white text, but those are people's stories, and we're connected with those people. So it was a very emotional experience. And it worked. The producer that was looking after me was just like, blimey, you know, that was pretty hard for him, I think.
Mm. Yeah. But the heart of that story, and we've said the hope word many times already in this podcast, but that's what it is. I mean, it was Helen, Mike's wife, who came up with the subtitle 300 Miles of Hope. And that hit the nail on the head, didn't it? Because it really was a mess. It felt like we were living through this period of generating hope. And the book has turned into that, and that the storytelling in there is that there is hope out there. And it is, as Mike said earlier on, it's the hope as a suicide bereaved parent. There's that hope that somehow you work out how to keep living. But it's also that message you can send out to people that there is hope in times of crisis, whether it's through individuals or organisations, that there is hope out there, hope on hand that you can access. And here's how to do it. Because again, there's loads of information in there in terms of who's out there, who can help. But it's that feeling of the message is that's quite clear in there, that the one thing we've got to do when in those really challenging, dark times is you've got to talk, you've got to be able to reach out for help. And that theme runs right through the book. So, we'd be fascinated to see what it's like when people other than us read it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and there's a really lovely metaphor there with like hope and, you know, walking these distances. And it is just a case of one foot in front of the other. That's how you get through something, right? Yeah. You just put one foot in front of the other and you just keep going the best you can. And I want to touch on, because the walk three is imminent as well. Is that right? Yeah. So what's...
18th of April.
What's the mileage this time around, guys?
About 500.
Another 500.
Another five, as you do. Yeah.
Don't tell him how far it is.
Involved.
Don't tell him how far it is.
No. Mike doesn't know where we're going yet.
No. It's a funny thing that these two love their maps. They love map reading. They love pointing the way. Yeah. So I've just taken a decision after a few little disagreements that I will let them get on with it. I'll let Napoleon and Wellington stand at the front and point where we're going, and I'll chat with whoever's there. I'm quite happy with that. So yes. We somehow make a team, don't we?
Somehow, yeah. Dysfunctional.
That's it, isn't it? It's the secret of any sort of relationship, isn't it? As one person who reads the map or one person who doesn't. That's it. That's how me and my wife do it.
Making it up as we go along.
That's it. As I said before, we want to highlight the virus offices down the East Coast. So it was Stirling, Edinburgh, Newcastle, Leeds, Norwich. But also, we are raising
money.
He's missed out Hull.
You know, but in the end of the day, we are raising money for them as well. You know, because for them to be able to expand and spread and whatever, you know, obviously they rely on goodwill people, and you know, we will raise as much as we can for them. So everything from we raise from our walks goes absolutely, you know, to Papyrus. Yeah. So
when we did our first walk, they got five offices or hubs around the country, and if you looked at the map, from looking at it in Norfolk, it didn't look as if there was any kind of Papyrus coverage down our way. They got the emergency line, which at the time was open from 9 a.m. till midnight. That was Hope Line. The money that we've raised on the kind of walks, as well as money from other places, has allowed them to advance their expansion. They're already going to expand, but it allowed them to advance their expansion plans. So there's now 18, I think, Andy, hubs or going to be hubs. So this walk is highlighting, look, this money that we've raised so far and the British public has given and they've got from other sources is allowing expansion into more and more communities across the country. Yeah. And then also the thing that I was so pleased about, and we all were, but I know that just from our experience, to have that emergency line go 24/7 that was a massive, massive tick for me as a dad that had been with a daughter in crisis. If that's brilliant. So it's definitely focusing it back on the charity. The second walk was all about kind of campaigning and pushing the government. This is definitely back on the charity. Look how it's expanded. It's there for all of us. It's a national charity. It is the National Suicide Prevention Charity for young people. And people need to be, like Mike's already said, people need to be aware of it. Mums and dads, don't live in ignorance. Don't live in, and shout about it. Tell people that there is this thing out there.
That's it. I mean, I recently moved to Anglesey, even though I still have a base in Manchester as well. So Anglesey, it's also known as Ynysmon in Welsh as well, and that's only right that I say it like that. You know, but we're hoping to walk there next year, you know, because it's a fairly rural community, and, you know, it's to walk around there and highlight that Papyrus is there is, I think it'll be absolutely massive as well. So this year, it isn't the last. We're still...
It's just the one lap, isn't it, mate?
Just the one lap. We might do crisscross it as well.
Oh, bloody hell! Tell us that.
The coastal path is absolutely beautiful, but yeah, hopefully we can get that off the ground next year as well.
Oh no, that's it's an amazing thing. If we're trying to make like change to the system, then of course, yeah, the government stuff and the petition stuff is so important, isn't it? But it's slow and it's frustrating. So it gets to the point of, while that plate is spinning in the background, let's fucking sort this out ourselves, right?
Yeah. Like, frustrating is a very good word. That's
calm down, Mike. Calm down.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. But we are hoping the Department of Education do the right thing. You know, what we've seen suicide prevention being taught to young people at school. And it's an amazing thing, especially with teenagers. You see them looking out the window. Is it really going in? But we've spoken to these teenagers afterwards, and you realize they now have a level of awareness they never had before. And this level of awareness to keep themselves safe, their friends safe, their family safe, it is absolutely invaluable. And the right thing to do is teach it in schools.
Yeah. 100%. Oh, guys, thank you so much for your time this evening. It's been, so much fun hanging out. And yeah, it's just amazing. All the best with this walk coming up, and all the best with the book, and just all the best with all of it, guys. Yeah, I appreciate your time so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us on.
Yes.
A big up to the Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.